So maybe you love the idea of having a garden, but you're cursed with a black thumb. Everything you've ever planted has rotted in the ground. Well, perhaps you can find some consolation. Between the covers of The Sweet Breathing of Plants, Women Writing on the Green World. This remarkable anthology was edited by Linda Hogan and Brenda Peterson, poets, writers, and gardeners themselves. Peterson says women and plant lore go way back.
I think that most people come to plants by observing and simply working with them. Even today, many people in this country have followed the lead of Europe and returned to homeopathics. There's a passion for plants these days, and I celebrate that. And part of the knowledge of this book is both ancient and what has been remembered, what was dismembered that has been remembered. And I think that women particularly keep that knowledge because we have the need for it. And we know that no matter how much we can make synthetically, many of the cures that are the best come from the forest, come from the plants, come from the Amazon, come from those places that part of our culture is also tearing down.
How has this knowledge been preserved? You've talked about women carrying the secrets through the ages. Is it an oral tradition of medicinal effectiveness in plants?
It's oral and it's physical. Anita Andrezi, who's the Yaqui native contributor in this book, talks about corn and all the varieties of corn that have been kept by her people throughout the millennia. They now have a movement that's on the internet to preserve native seeds. You know, if you left it to the seed companies, they would just do what sells. They would just do carnations forever. They would not keep the lowly trillium. They would not necessarily keep a form of blue corn that needs to be preserved. So a lot of these women are actually involved quite professionally and scientifically in keeping certain seeds alive that may seem useless to the business world of plants.
Many of the writings in the book are about plants in the environment, the medicinal properties of plants. There is some comment on more familiar, perhaps, association of women and flowers, the stereotype of ladies mooning over pretty bouquets. Isabel Allende has a very funny little bit about bouquets and their rituals, and I wondered if you'd read that.
This is from The Language of Flowers by Isabel Allende. In the past, flowers, among their many enhancements, had the task of transmitting subtle, amorous messages. But in all the haste of the 20th century, this art has become a dead language. I don't see any advantage to reviving it. It's like Sanskrit. There's no one to speak it with. But just in case the reader of these pages is given to moments of madness, I'm going to devote a few paragraphs to the language of flowers. The symbolism of flowers reached its apogee in the mid-19th century during the reign of Queen Victoria in England. Although it wasn't there the language originated, but in Turkey, where it was used to send coded love notes within the harem. Lady Mary Wortley Montagu, who as the wife of a British ambassador lived in that country from 1716 to 1718, introduced the language of flowers into England. It evolved through several decades until it became a romantic epidemic, so sophisticated that by using different combinations in a bouquet, it was possible to maintain a long correspondence without a single written word.
Kind of changes your notion of the communication of flowers, doesn't it?
Yes.
Both you and your co-editor, Linda Hogan, have pieces in the book. There is a poem that she wrote about plants having, well, I guess you'd say more important messages to deliver. Could you read Bamboo for us?
Yes, this is one of my favorite poems by my co-editor, Linda Hogan. It almost didn't make it in the book because she's so shy, but our editor, our wonderful editor, Becky Salatin, insisted upon it. Bamboo. First woman was made of slender bones, like these that stand upright together in the rich, green world of daylight. At night, they are a darkened forest of sisters who grow quickly in moving water and talk in the clattering breeze, as if each is an open throat rising to speak. I tell a man about this beautiful creaking world, how it flowers all at once. He has been to war. He says, with bamboo, they do terrible things to men and women. I look at this bamboo. It did not give permission to soldiers. It is imprisoned in its own skin. The stalks are restless about this. They have lived too long in the world of men. They are hollow inside. Lord, are you listening to this? Plants are climbing to heaven to talk to you.
That last line is one that you suspect women through the ages have uttered in different forms.
And with different flowers.
Yes. There is a piece of yours in this anthology as well. It's called Killing Our Elders, and you had a very personal experience, I gather, of both knowing old-growth trees in the Pacific Northwest and of the destruction of them, the logging of them. Were you raised near
Yes, I was raised
the
in the Pacific Northwest in Oregon, between the border of Oregon and California in the Plumas National Forest. My father was in the Forest Service. And in my lifetime, in 50 years, I have seen the great old trees fall. It is a tragedy of my life as well as, I think, the American life. And now as we look to a new administration which is not protecting those old trees, this essay is, I think, even more relevant than when I wrote it several years ago when people were practicing a kind of logging that was panic logging. They were worried that their logging would be banned, and they were logging in a rampage day and night. Every 5 minutes we would count a logging truck coming out of the forest. And I thought, if we were in another culture, we would know that these were our elders. So I wrote this essay, Killing Our Elders. As a nation, are we still so young? Do we still worship what is newborn or newly invented so much that we will be eternal adolescents, rebelling against the old order of trees or people? If our 200-year-old country were a 200-year-old Douglas fir, would we see ourselves as no more than prime timber to cut down and sell to Japan? Maturity teaches us limits and respect for those limits within and around us. This means limiting perhaps our needs, seeing the forest for the timber. If we keep sending all our old trees to the sawmills to die, if we keep shunting off our elders to nursing homes to die, if we keep denying death by believing we can replace it with what's new, we will not only have no past left us, we will have no future.
In that same essay, you mentioned the General Sherman tree. I had no idea there was a tree, even a sequoia, that was, 3,800 years old?
Yes, yes. It's rather frightening to think that we are the stewards of the world's many of the most ancient trees, and yet as a country, we seem to be so very adolescent and not mature about how to preserve what has been given us.
Among all the pieces in the collection, do you have a favorite?
One of my favorites was one of the originals, which is called Ode to Mold, written by a first-time author. And she talks about unconsciously growing mold in her refrigerator and becoming aware that she was, in fact, a plants woman because of that. And then she talks about a sourdough starter that goes back in her family to the 1800s. So it was an unexpected privilege to print that. There's also a wonderful essay by a first-time writer named Lisa Quayle about these radioactive tumbleweeds that are rolling around here in eastern Washington, and the women in their radioactive suits and their pitchforks who drive around the Hanford Reservation, and they take these tumbleweeds and pitch them into their cars and drive them off and bury them as nuclear waste. So beware those tumbleweeds.
It's an astonishing idea, isn't it? Paints a picture
yes.
that you don't particularly want to see.
Yes.
But then I was thinking that some of us may have in our refrigerators mold starters that have been there almost as long as the sourdough starter that you're your author
yes,
talked about.
Yes, and who knows what recipes and cures of maladies may come from that refrigerator mold. There's also a wonderful piece by Linda Hazelstrom about mulching, and she ends up mulching old love letters, which I think many of us might have a lot, that would help other things grow.
One of the most vivid memories is the piece about the mint snowball, and it seems a fitting place to conclude. Would you read just a little bit about the mint snowball for us?
Yes. Mint snowball. My great-grandfather on my mother's side ran a drugstore in a small town in central Illinois. He sold pills and rubbing alcohol from behind the big cash register and creamy ice cream from the soda fountain. My mother remembers the counter's long polished sweep, its shining face. My great-grandfather had one specialty, a mint snowball, which he had invented. Some people drove all the way in from Decatur just to taste it. First, he stirred fresh mint leaves with sugar and secret ingredients in a small pot on the stove for a very long time. He concocted a flamboyant elixir of mint. Its scent hung to his fingers even after he washed his hands. Then he shaved ice into tiny particles and served it mounded in a glass dish, permeated with mint syrup, scoops of rich vanilla ice cream to each side. My mother took a bite of minty ice and ice cream mixed together. The mint snowball tasted like winter. She closed her eyes to see the Swiss village my great-grandfather's parents came from, snow frosting the roofs, glistening, dangling spokes of ice.
Brenda Peterson, with an excerpt from Mint Snowball by Naomi Shihab Nye. It's one of the pieces featured in The Sweet Breathing of Plants, Women Writing on the Green World, co-edited by Linda Hogan and Brenda Peterson.